Word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Long before he was pushing the boundaries on television's Politically Incorrect or hosting Real Time on HBO, Bill Maher was a stand-up comedian. He still does about 50 shows a year in venues all over the country. And he's coming to the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord next Saturday, October 5th, to share some of the biting wit that is made of one of the leading satirists in America today. Many love him, some hate him, especially conservatives, his frequent targets. Here he is calling out House Republicans who voted to slash the food stamp program and to defund Obamacare. This is from the opening monologue of last Friday evening's Real Time.
Oh, actually what they did was they passed a bill that funds the government if Obama repeals Obamacare. And shows them his birth certificate and punches himself in the face and touches a dead squirrel. That's.
And Bill Maher is with us on the line from where? Someplace fabulous, I'm guessing, Bill.
Well, I think where I live is fabulous, but it's right in the middle of Los Angeles. Some people would think it was too smoggy, but we're doing better with that.
I guess so. You know, I watched one of your HBO specials. You're doing stand-up. You're not wearing a suit. There's no panel, really, to bounce things off, and you don't have your visual or video props. How is the stand-up experience different for you than doing the show?
Well, it's what I started with, and it's, by the way, what I'll end with. You know, everyone on TV does get thrown off at some point. I have no illusions. It's been a wonderful 20-year run. I can't believe it's been that long. But, and, you know, they chucked Johnny Carson off TV when he was 67 and the biggest star in TV, so I know it happens to everybody, and I'll just go back to stand-up full-time, which is what I started with. I enjoy it more than ever and more than anything because as much as I love a panel, there's nothing quite like just you and the audience. The show is a hybrid of laughter, we hope, and serious stuff that, you know, isn't necessarily funny. But stand-up has to be all about getting people to laugh. About serious subjects, yes, the subjects I cover are similar to the ones I'm interested in covering on the show. But it's only about, you know, where the punchlines really live.
Well, I wondered, watching you on Real Time, if this, you know, this dogged kind of aggressive pushback that you have against conservatives or any kind of ideologue, really, I wonder if that was kind of honed by stand-up. I mean, you must have to learn
totally.
To steel yourself,
course.
Right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one reason I still do stand up. It's a great way to get out and see the country that I'm talking about. You know, if you're just sitting in one place in America and then you every week you're pontificating about America, it's kind of phony. I'm always amused when the Tea Party people say things like, I want my country back, because I wonder how much of the country have you really seen that you suppose you need to get back? Of course, they were saying that about 10 minutes after Obama got into office, as if he had, you know, transformed this country into a Kenyan socialist kingdom right away. And if they did what I do and get out in America and see it every week, and I think they would find out it hasn't really gone anywhere. It's still the same Kentucky Fried place it's always been.
Here's a bit of you from your 2010 HBO special, Bill Maher, But I'm Not Wrong, answering the question asked since the financial crisis, where did all the money go?
I'll tell you where the money went. It never existed in the first place because America doesn't make anything anymore. That's a little secret about our economy. What have we made lately?
War.
And Snuggies. Right? That's what we make, bullshit Snuggies and ShamWows and Flobies and Bedazzlers.
You joke a lot about the kind of dumb things that Americans buy and do. That's often often the topics of your new rules segment.
Correct.
And that's one of the things that conservatives criticize you for, saying that you think Americans are stupid. What do you say?
Well, Americans are stupid. I mean, look, it's a big country, and there's room for everybody. And certainly within this nation of over 300 million people, there's a fabulous, smart, Western European-style country. It's just surrounded by a bunch of rednecks. You know, I mean, I can't help it that something like 60% of people believe in the Noah's Ark story, literally. I mean, that's a dumb place. But the great thing is that when, no matter where I go in America, and I go to the reddest of the red states, you can always find so many progressive intellectual people. And, of course, that's one reason why it's so much fun to go to red states, because they come out of the woodwork to see someone who thinks like them, which they don't often see. Christopher Hitchens used to tell me the same thing, that he would go and have a book reading in Alabama, and he would be shocked that, you know, thousands of atheists came out of the woodwork in Alabama. Richard Dawkins has told me the same thing. They're out there. They're just marbled into the population.
What are you guessing here in Concord, New Hampshire? Of course, you know, you cover New Hampshire in the first of the nation primary every 4 years. What's your guess about Concord?
Oh, I'm not worried about Concord. I worry. I'm going to Mississippi next year. That makes me worry a little. But no, I mean, New Hampshire's great. New Hampshire's New England. I mean, you know, they can be a little flinty, but they're smart. And even their conservative politics, I don't find to be off-putting. It's not, it's, you know, sometimes they compare the New Hampshire primary, because it comes right on the heels of the Iowa caucus.
Uh-huh.
The Iowa caucus is dominated by evangelical knuckle-draggers. That's not New Hampshire.
You know, you manage to insult a lot of people. You must get a lot of good hate mail, that's what I'm guessing.
Well, there's no more mail.
Okay, I mean, you know, hate messaging.
Well, that's interesting you bring that up, because the editorial, what we call the editorial, it's the last new rule on our show, the last monologue I do on Friday night, was all about Twitter and the hate that's out there on Twitter. One point I made in it was, I used to think it was just me because I'm so controversial, and I understood that. But it's not just me. It's everybody. And it's funny, after I read it and the show was over, I was talking with Billy Crystal, who was there, Joy Behar, and Chris Hayes, and we all said the same thing. We used to like to read our Twitter feed, or at least we tried, but it's just so full of people who just seem to have nothing to do but offer their hate. And, of course, parts of the editorial that I think the audience found most amusing was when I read the ones where I was saying, I understand why they hate me with my controversy, but why Jonah Hill? And then I would read this just horrible diatribe against lovable, kind, funny Jonah Hill. Why hate him?
Why the Cheesecake Factory?
And Cheesecake Factory. I mean, come on. And it is. I think it's a legitimate question for a bigger intellectual than I to answer for real. What is causing all the hate?
Well, let's hear a little bit more from last week's show. Here you are talking about the new Pope, Francis.
He's only been in office a few months. First it was atheists can get into heaven. Then it was I don't judge the gays. Then it was we're thinking about letting the priest marry. This week he said we should not here in the Catholic Church be obsessed about abortion or gay marriage or contraception. I know. And then he lit up a joint. And confirmed that he was dating Miley Cyrus. I mean, it's this guy. I am not exactly sure what this Pope wants, but I'm starting to fear it's my time slot.
So are you softening up on the Pope? Are you on your way to being saved, Bill Maher?
I am about to be saved, correct. Look, I've always loved this Pope, and it's funny because Chris Hayes was on Friday, and we were talking about the fact that we had something in common. Our fathers both were huge fans of the last liberal pope we have, which was Pope John, from 1958 to 1963. I was a toddler, but I do remember my father being so happy in that period because Irish-American. He had John Kennedy in the White House, a liberal Irish Democrat, and he had Pope Paul. He was a Catholic, of course, raised Catholic, in the Vatican, and that was the golden era. And when Pope John went away or died or got poisoned or whatever happened to him, and Pope Paul took over, my father didn't like him because he was conservative, and it was back to that old Catholic stodgy, let's emphasize the dogma and not the love. And finally, now we have another pope all these years later who is reminiscent of Pope John, who's all about, let's open the windows here and let some fresh air in. Now, I, of course, am not religious and would never consider being a Catholic again, but I think it's terrific for all the people who do follow religion and use it as a guide that there's a guy out there who's doing that and emphasizing the right things, because after all, Jesus Christ is a pretty terrific moral philosopher if you take away the bells and whistles and the magic act.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because your film, Religious, focused on one of your favorite whipping posts, is belief in God, you know, or religious fanaticism. It was one of the highest grossing documentary films ever made. But I wonder if there is a danger of being fanatic about atheism. I mean, if we consider that Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., all of those people had religious beliefs that drove them to be socially progressive. Here's a question from one of our listeners. Do you really believe that ridiculing deeply held personal beliefs and cultural traditions is an effective way to promote open-mindedness?
Yes, I do. And anyone who makes fun of religion is doing a public service. Sometimes people ask me in interviews, you know, what is the historical figure you most identify with? And I always say Toto from The Wizard of Oz, because he was the little dog who pulled back the curtain and revealed that, you know, the wizard was really just a guy with a microphone and a light show saying, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Obviously, religion has done good in the history of the world at times. Of course, it still does. I mean, Catholic Charities feed the poor, and I guess it does keep some people in mind. But, you know, I could go through the list of horrors that religion is also responsible for. The Crusades and the Inquisition and 9/11 was a faith-based initiative. And about half the wars the world has ever fought were over, you know, I know who the big guy is and you don't, and this is still going on. It's endless, the misery that this nonsense has caused the world. So on balance, you don't need it. You can do good works and be a moral person without believing in this childish Bronze Age myth. So why don't we do it that way?
We're speaking with Bill Maher, comedian, author, host of Real Time on Friday nights on HBO. And he's on his way to Concord. He's going to be there next Saturday at the Capital Center for the Arts on Saturday, October the 5th. A number of people, Bill, especially young people, or let's say in the young adult cohort, say that they get their news from comedy shows like yours specifically, like The Daily Show, The Colbert Report. Do you ever think of yourself as a news show or a news anchor?
No, I don't. But I do take my job seriously of trying to catch people up on what they may have missed in the news that week. We are on Friday night. And I've always seen our show as a kind of a that was the week that was kind of show. It is a wrap-up show, and I hear this from people all the time. You know, I have kids, I have two jobs, whatever. People are busy. They don't have time to cover the news and read it like I do because it's my business. They are doing their business. So I do very, very carefully try to make sure that in some form in the show, and we have a lot of different elements. We have two single interviews, we have a panel, we have new rules, we have monologue, we have that editorial at the end. Somewhere in one of those elements, I do want to hit the stories that I think are important that people should have become aware of during that week. So in that sense, there is some news anchor editing that I do. But, you know, look, people are not going to pay attention to any of it unless they're entertained.
You seem to pull out a lot of zingers, a lot of facts, a lot of things that people don't necessarily know about in the general public. So are you doing that work? Is your staff doing that work? Where do you get this from?
Absolutely, my staff. I couldn't begin to do this show without them. I mean, I'm never a good researcher. I'm a good editor, I think. But, yeah, they're great at finding stuff. And, of course, all you have to do is read, you know, a decent newspaper, and you know more than 95% of the people in the country because they don't read a newspaper at all. And there are a lot of stories, I feel, that people don't get caught up on because the normal media, the TV media, which is if they're going to watch news at all, that's where they're going to get it, they don't cover stories like that. I mean, I had on Nicholas Kristof a few months ago. And I said to him, you know, and he had a book about the basic genocide that goes on against women mm-hmm. in the world today.
Yeah.
And he said more girls have been killed in the last 50 years just because they were girls than men were killed in all the battles of the 20th century. And I said that is maybe the most eye-opening fact that I didn't know ever in the 20 years I've been doing this on television. Mm. That's very important to me, is to get to those stories that the media ignores.
It's a lot of work, but you're out on the road all the time. I'm curious about what sustains you. I mean, what keeps you going on what looks like a pretty punishing schedule?
Well, some people like punishing schedules. I mean, I've never been good with free time. I'm getting a little better at taking vacations now. I took one in August when we were off. But in general, that's what I enjoy. If I'm going to travel, I want there to be a show at the end of the plane ride. That's what makes the plane ride worth it, is that you go on stage and you make people laugh for a couple of hours. That's really what turns me on. So, and also, I must say, when you're beginning as a comedian, it's so painful and rotten that now that it's great, I might as well redeem it.
Bill Maher, comedian, author, host of Real Time on Friday nights on HBO. Thank you so much
for
joining us.
Thank you so much. It was real fun.
Bill Maher will be at the Capitol Center for the Arts Saturday. That's October 5th. For links to more on the show and to Bill and to see a montage of some of the best moments of Real Time, you can visit wordofmouthradio.org. Don't go away. There's more Word of Mouth coming up after the break.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Those of us who went to public school in New Hampshire will likely recall hopping in the school bus for a visit to the Museum of Science in Boston or maybe to Sturbridge Village. For decades, schools have embraced field trips as positive and popular learning experiences. Today, museums, cultural institutions, and the American Association of School Administrators note a steep drop in the number of field trips taken by schools. More than half of American schools did away with the learning excursions in 2010 alone. Researchers at the University of Arkansas are studying the educational effects of such a drop-off. J. Philip Green is endowed chair and head of the Department of Education Reform at University of Arkansas. He's also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. J. Philip Green, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I note that the Field Museum in Chicago lost 100,000 student guests last year. What are some of the factors contributing to such a dramatic drop in field trip attendance?
Well, one force that's reducing field trips is budgetary. So as budgets get tight, it's easier to cut field trips than other expenses, in part because people making these decisions within schools might see field trips as an unnecessary frill. So that's one source of pressure. Another pressure on field trips is high-stakes testing. So the more that we are pushing schools to emphasize reading and math, which are very important, the more they think they can't get away from the classroom to have these other kinds of experiences. And so that's another reason why they're cutting back on field trips.
For those schools that are still conducting field trips, the nature of that experience is also changing. It's something that you note, that there's a shift to sort of reward-based field trips. Can you explain that shift?
Sure. Well, culturally enriching field trips are to places that kids don't know they like. And we want to expose them to these places because we think that with exposure, they'll learn to like them and go back there on their own in the future. Reward trips are to places that kids already like, that we know they already like, to places like amusement parks and movie theaters and sporting events and bowling alleys. And these are done to reward students for good behavior or good performance on tests. And sometimes there are things that the teachers enjoy a little bit more, too. So there's been a kind of a shift away from culturally enriching trips towards reward trips over the last several years.
In a very unscientific way, I was talking with some friends about field trips, and they're some of the most memorable school experiences for many of us. So that's purely anecdotal, but your team actually went to work quantifying the value of field trips. How did you approach the research first?
What we did is the first of its kind. We randomly assigned students to having a field trip experiment, like a medical study. So what happened was the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art opened in Northwest Arkansas. It was the first major art museum built in four decades, and it was built in an area that had never had an art museum before. So there was huge demand to go, and the museum couldn't accommodate all groups at once. So what we did is we assigned by lottery which groups could come now and which would come later on, and we could then compare those that won the lottery to come now to those that had their trips deferred to identify the effect of the trip with really high confidence, just like we do in medical trials.
Okay, so how many students did you survey and what was the result?
In total, we're talking about almost 11,000 students, almost 500 teachers, and more than 500,000 bits of information were collected in this study. So it was a very big effort. And what we learned is that students actually get a lot of benefits out of field trips, more than we might have expected from a single outing. So, for example, we found that students learned a lot of academic content. They pick up a lot of factual information. They improve their critical thinking skills. They also have their values changed. So a field trip can be a broadening experience, and it seems to improve their tolerance and empathy. We also found that it helps create cultural consumers. Kids come back to the museum at a higher rate if they get to go on a field trip. They come back on their own or with their families.
This is the first time they've been to this fantastic new museum from the sounds of it. Do you think that you can carry these results into other field trip experiences?
Well, we actually did a companion study, which was a long-term study of the effect of field trips to a performing arts center. So students went to see plays and dance performances and musical performances. And we looked at the cumulative effect of those field trips through seventh grade. And we found the same pattern of benefits from field trips to a different kind of activity. Instead of an art museum, it was a performing arts center. And instead of 3 weeks, we're looking at the effects over several years. And the effects endure and compound.
Did those benefits change at all across demographic groups?
Yes, the benefits were much greater for disadvantaged groups. So minority students, low-income students, and rural students were the students who had the largest gains in all of the measures that we collected, sometimes 2 to 3 times as large as the average effect. So students who may not have the opportunity to have these experiences if the school does not take them are the ones who benefit the most when the school does take them.
So you are looking at a visit to a museum. How do you think the kind of more reward-based model, in other words, taking kids to a water park rather than seeing a museum that they've never seen, do those have any measurable effects, or did you study that?
Well, we don't know. That's a good question, and in future research we can look at it. But the water park doesn't claim to have these benefits. It's not attempting to increase critical thinking skills or provide a broadening experience that increases tolerance or empathy. And so it would be quite unexpected if it produced those benefits, despite not in the least bit trying to do those things. Now, there may be other kinds of benefits from reward trips. So, for example, it may improve school morale. It may motivate students to behave better and perform better on tests, which is why there are these rewards. So I'm not saying that these reward trips have no benefits. It's just that we're missing out on a culturally enriching activity when we don't even try to have it.
J. Philip Green, with school budgets being slashed, there are going to be arguments from the art teachers, the music teachers, the drama teachers, the athletics coaches, that their departments are the ones that deserve the funding. Can you summarize a case for us right now of why field trips are important?
Well, field trips are important because they demonstrate to students that learning is something that's not confined to the classroom. It occurs throughout their lives, in all aspects of their lives, if only they were to approach experiences in that way. And so if we want to create lifelong learners and broaden the set of experiences that students have, then I think field trips are a really critical part of our education experience.
J. Philip Green, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
J. Philip Green is head of the Department of Education Reform at the University of Arkansas. He's also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. His team of researchers tried to calculate the benefits or quantify the benefits of taking school field trips. You can find more information on that at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, who couldn't use a field trip? Luckily, today is Smithsonian Magazine's annual Museum Day Live. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org to download a free ticket that will get you and a guest into any participating Smithsonian Museum, including the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Museum in Concord, the Aviation Museum of New Hampshire in Manchester, and Strawberry Bank Museum, where you can learn about Portsmouth's long love affair with beer. Here's Strawberry Bank President and CEO Larry Yerdon with a preview.
We have an exhibition open right now. It's called Tapping Portsmouth, and it's about how the brewing industry shaped Portsmouth. We forget Portsmouth's economy was very much wrapped up with the breweries. In fact, they were roaring right along until Prohibition, and they were an important part of the economy.
Well, while that may not be the focus for the 7th grade class trip, there is plenty for kids to learn at Strawberry Bank, along with some pleasures for the over 21 set. For a full list of participating museums, a link to download your tickets, and more on Smithsonian's annual Museum Day Live, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Here in Concord, flocks of fourth graders are boarding school buses to get a glimpse of something you definitely won't see in a classroom. Falcons. Right now, birds of prey are migrating in massive numbers from their breeding grounds in the north to their wintering grounds down south. Independent producer Jack Rodolico met up with a group of kid scientists on a field trip to the Carter Hill apple orchard and filed this report.
Hillary Chapman is wrangling a barred owl out of a box. The owl isn't too happy. On the grass in front of Hillary, dozens of fourth graders ooh and ah when they see the bird.
Okay, so this owl was in a collision, in an accident with a car. So this bird was not able to go back into the wild.
This captive owl is sort of a prop, something to get the kids psyched about the wild birds of prey migrating overhead. It's clear and sunny at Carter Hill Apple Orchard, a perfect day to scan the skies. And these 9-year-olds have been studying.
I think that the owl wing, it's much more smoother than the osprey wing.
I hope we can see a peregrine falcon. That would be cool. They're over like 200 miles per hour going down to dive.
And the red-tailed hawk can live to be 30 or 35.
This is one of the best days of the year to look for birds of prey. Between September and October, about 15 species migrate right over this hill. And this week, we'll see the peak of the broad-winged hawk migration. Broadwings move in numbers unseen by any other species. Just a few days ago, spectators observed 14,000 hawks in just one day from a mountain in Massachusetts.
I think raptors are just so captivating in general.
Phil Brown is the director of Raptor Observatories for New Hampshire Audubon. Raptors, by the way, are birds of prey. Hawks, falcons, eagles, and owls. Migration is the best time of year to get kids hooked on what Brown calls gateway birds.
And that just kind of hooks them on, you know, what's going on with raptors and maybe encourages them to look up a little bit more. So hopefully we'll see a few birds today, too.
So here's the layout at the orchard. There are 200 fourth graders split into four groups rotating through stations. Two stations have live birds, a barred owl, and a red-tailed hawk. Then on top of an open tower, a couple biologists help kids scan the skies for migrating birds. There's also a weather station and a station where kids fiddle with bird parts.
Looking at the heads and beaks of birds, this is a duck.
Now buzzing from group to group is the coordinator of the Concord School District's Project C. That stands for Science and Environmental Education. Her name? Luann Pigeon.
Occasionally I get a falcon joke, but that's, you know, the kids are kind.
Project C creates hands-on and often outdoor programs that complement local science curriculum.
We just try to enhance what they're doing and support what they're doing in the classroom.
Project C has been working with kindergarten through fifth grade in Concord since 1970. Its longevity, in part, comes from the support of classroom teachers, who are hard-pressed on their own to cram hands-on lessons into precious little class time.
You know, when you have a half an hour or 45 minutes in the classroom, it's more difficult. But when they come to us, they have 2 hours. And the other beauty is that we see every class at that grade level.
Don't move your feet! Don't move your feet, sorry!
Over at the binocular practice station, there's some action. 3 broad-winged hawks are circling up into the sky. But one little cluster of kids isn't having much luck spotting them.
It's turning right now. Use your eyes. Bring your binoculars right up to your eyes.
Okay, I'm trying to see them. I can't really see them. Come on.
It's pretty tough to find birds, right? Isn't it really hard?
Yeah, I'd say so, really. It's really hard.
They're so far away. They're so far away that it's hard to see them even with their binoculars.
So what do you do when it's frustrating like that? What do you do?
You try and look for them even more.
You can't really create a moment like this in a classroom. As the excitement winds down, the kids board buses and the instructors relax in the shade. They need a little rest. Another group of 209-year-olds is on the way. For Word of Mouth.
For Word of Mouth.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Jack.
I'm Jack.
I'm Jack Rodorito.
I'm Jack Puerto Rico.
I'm Jack Rodolico.
Don't go away. There's more Word of Mouth coming up after the break. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. The military entertainment complex has been quietly growing for decades. The Pentagon has helped sponsor a few Hollywood films, along with the development of the first personal computers. The DoD budget also funded the MIT graduate students who created the first video game. For decades, the military has used video games and digital simulations to train troops.
Your objective is to locate and activate a radio transponder that looks just like this one. You pass or fail as a team. So don't leave anyone behind.
That sound from the video game America's Army. It was originally developed to rebrand the military in the eyes of teenagers. It is now an extremely effective recruiting tool and has worked its way into public school lesson plans. I spoke with Corey Mead. He's author of Warplay, Video Games, and the Future of Armed Conflict, about the origins of America's Army under Colonel Casey Wardinsky. It was Wardinsky's vision that led the Army to invest millions in the creation of America's Army.
Well, it's funny because when you talk about the Army as a broad thing, it really stemmed from a few visionary individuals, Casey Wardinsky being the prime example. He was a colonel, and he actually was the, in effect, he was the top economist in the Army. And what the Army had found in the late 1990s was that their recruitment numbers were just terrible. And part of that was because people had this impression of the Army as being by far the worst of the services. It was considered sort of dirty, unglamorous, something for people who didn't have any other shots in life. And so what a game could do is, first of all, it could put across an image of the Army that showed, from his perspective, that it wasn't just, you know, infantry trudging through the muck and getting shot, like the image of Vietnam that was still stuck in a lot of people's heads. And then secondly, he wanted to attract the kind of recruits that the Army would actually want, in other words, higher skilled people. And part of this was economic for him, because the Army loses tons of money each year on people who sign up and then end up dropping out of basic training. So the Army wastes hundreds of thousands of dollars per person on that. So he had this idea of, hey, we'll have a game. It'll show that there's 200 different specialties in the Army. You don't just have to be the infantry guy with the gun, right? And it'll also help attract the kind of people who we want, because they can play this game and they can see what the reality of life in the Army is like. And if they don't like it, they won't waste our time and sign up and then end up dropping out.
Games that the military is now developing don't only simulate conflict, but some of them, like you write about Tactical Iraq, this was developed in 2005, right. VBS2, what kind of skills are they trying to strengthen?
It's everything that the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq threw at the soldiers that was different from the traditional role of a soldier going in and shooting, right, or having a large tank battle. And it's everything that's tied in with counterinsurgency. So that's building relationships with locals, that which involves speaking the language. It's understanding cultural cues. It's using diplomacy at times, along with obviously like the shooting and the violence and the force that goes with it. So what these games were intended to do is, in a very quick time, like with the game like Tactical Iraqi, it gives you 2 weeks of training on the basic language and cultural skills you'd need, like understanding that keeping your sunglasses on is an insult when you're talking to an Iraqi. Mm. Of course, the flip side of that is asking whether 2 weeks on a game is actually going to give someone the real skills they need, right, or whether it's just sort of a cover.
Oh, I guess that becomes one of the unanswerable questions here. What is the balance between this virtual training and this kind of muddy boots training that soldiers have traditionally had to go through?
That relates to a broader question, which is that the military itself hasn't necessarily done the most successful implementing of this game-based training because it hasn't developed what that relationship should be between boots-on-the-ground training and virtual training. Some colonels, for example, that are big believers in the virtual training will take their people through, you know, a week or two of training on one of the major games, right? There's other people that might be more stuck in the past who won't train their soldiers through that as well. And so you have this issue of, are people getting unequal training? And, you know, the Pentagon itself is really lacking in having a sort of overall coherent policy of how this new training should be used.
Let's go back to America's Army. 30 years ago, the idea of having a sort of war game inside of schools was almost unthinkable. How is it used? How is it taught?
So what happened is that there's this educational content provider called Project Lead the Way, in upstate New York, and they're very much focused on STEM education, which is the big buzz these days. Mm-hmm. It's science, technology, engineering, mathematics. So they are pre-approved in all 50 states to give their curricula to whatever public school district wants to use it. So the Army, in wanting to get into the schools, that was blocked from a lot of schools because people don't want the military recruiting, right? So what it did was it provided its game to Project Lead the Way. And since it's bundled with Project Lead the Way, it doesn't have to be approved by any school districts or boards or anything like that because it's bundled in with this pre-approved curricula. You know, and interestingly enough, when you take America's Army, the guy, Casey Wardinsky, who developed the game, retired from the Army, and he's now a school superintendent. He started in Denver, and now he's down in Huntsville, which is the same city where America's Army, the game, is still made. And so he's doing this brand new curriculum that's starting literally this fall of doing a separate cyber war preparation curricula. And if they want to, the students that thrive on that, they'll be mentored by West Point folks and Pentagon folks. And then after they graduate high school, they won't go to college. They'll go immediately to work for Army Cyber Command. And this is nothing new. This has been going back decades, right? That you'll get the skills you need to succeed in the civilian world if you join up with the military. Mm-hmm. This is sort of like a sexy new way of making that old argument.
Of being all that you can be.
Being all that you can be, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Well, you also make a point that it's not preparing for war, but dealing with its aftermath. That is really one of the most important video game-related legacies. So it can be used to therapeutic effect. What are some of the things that are being done to help people who have been through conflict and have ended up with PTSD or are suffering from traumatic brain injuries?
The biggest initiative so far, and I think the one that's gotten the best results in terms of treating PTSD, is this game called Virtual Iraq, Virtual Afghanistan, developed by this guy named Skip Rizzo, who has a long history of treating traumatic brain injuries. And essentially, he took this game that the Army developed that didn't work very well for it, called Full Spectrum Warrior, and he used the imagery from that game. And the way it works is that whoever the patient is, you sit at a table with a computer screen in front of you, and you wear this virtual reality helmet, and your therapist is right next to you. And what they do is you talk out the experience that traumatized you over and over and over again over an 11 or 12-week period. And as you're doing that, they're adding visuals into the game on the screen that are the same things or as close as possible to what you're telling them traumatized you. You know, you're wearing this virtual reality helmet, so it's incredibly immersive for you. And there's also, it's kind of like smell-o-rama. They have smells that replicate whatever you would have smelled at the time. And you're holding a replica of an M16 rifle in your hand, so you have that. And the point is to re-traumatize you over and over again and get you to the point of real panic with this experience. But with that, to take you through it every time because your therapist is guiding the experience and you're talking it out with them the whole time so that eventually you become not numb to the experience, but you come to realize that you can get through the experience.
Corey, what comes across to me is that you're very interested in a lot of these technologies that are being used and training methods and tools and educational devices, but also a little wary. I mean, is that how you come away?
I think there are a lot of really innovative potentially mold-breaking ways in which the military is ahead of some civilian agencies in applying maybe new methods of learning and new methods of treatment that are conducive to 21st century realities. But it's not something that should ever be excused for an overall comprehensive approach to either education or the treating of trauma.
Corey Mead, author of War Play, Video Games, and the Future of Armed Conflict, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You could read more about the book and more about the spillover between the military's video game strategy and public school education. All that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Popular culture has cast the sniper as the lone wolf of warfare. The truth is that long-distance shooting is a two-man job. The sniper may hold, aim, and fire the rifle, but it is the other half of the team, the spotter, who does the ballistics calculations of distance and drop and the slant of the earth, along with wind and other atmospheric factors. They are typically equipped with a scope and a notepad, sometimes even a laptop. So what if there were a weapon that could do all the arithmetic for you, transforming even amateur firearm users into deadly sharpshooters? Well, now there is.
Who is Tracking Point? We're an applied tech company that created the world's first smart rifles. And we've democratized accuracy, and we've entirely disrupted the shooting experience. I'm allowing a guy who's untrained to be able to become very, very proficient within minutes.
Derek Mead is host of the short film called Longshot, which covers his investigation and field test of the so-called smart rifle created by the Texas-based company Tracking Point Solutions. Longshot was produced by Vice Magazine's tech-based video channel Motherboard, and Derek is also editor-in-chief of Motherboard. Derek, thank you for being with us.
And thank you for having me.
Also on the line with us is Longshot producer and Motherboard's features editor, Brian Anderson, also featured in the film. Brian, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having us.
So, Derek, tell us a little bit more about the weapon, how it works.
The idea that a lot of people have trouble comprehending for long-range shooting is you actually have to aim your gun way above the target to compensate for the bullet dropping. And it's kind of weird if you're aiming at a deer and you have to actually aim at the sky 20 feet above the deer. It's not going to feel right. And basically what this scope does is it calculates all of those ballistics for you and then recalibrates the video screen on the scope to make it look like you're aiming at your target while you're actually aiming to compensate for wind and everything else.
One of the big differences I noted in the film is that you hold onto the trigger, and usually, you know, when you fire a gun, you pull the trigger and the shot goes, but this actually does its calculations, comes back to you, and then makes the shot.
Yeah, it does. And that's something that, you know, as a fairly novice shooter myself, it was definitely a strange experience. Shooting a normal rifle, you pull the trigger and it makes it a loud bang and, you know, you hope that you aimed properly. And this one, it only lets it fire when you're aimed exactly where it wants you to be aimed. And that it obviously helps with accuracy, but it also kind of removes you a little bit from the decision making.
To fire the rifle, you squeeze and hold the trigger. Whereas most rifles, as soon as you squeeze, the rifle fires. Well, our rifle will not fire until the reticle is lined back up with the tag point that you just set on the target by pushing the tag button.
Hit! Nailed it.
There it is. I couldn't even see it. Just a huge explosion, and someone tells me I did a good job.
How about you, Brian? Both of you had a chance to test the PGF. First, how experienced were you, and how far were you able to accurately shoot using this PGF, or precision-guided firearm?
I believe when I shot the PGF, that was maybe the sixth time I had fired a gun. I shot at about 200 yards. I shot a trophy feral hog. These things have overrun parts of Texas, and Tracking Point does a lot of their live fire testing on these animals just as a means of population control. So it took all but 5 minutes of waiting for a hog to show up, and next thing I knew, a very loud bang reverberated through the stuffy blind that I was in, and someone patted me on the back and said, "You dropped it right there," and that was it. I experienced the life force.
Dropped you right there.
It was the first time Brian had ever killed an animal, and the sixth time he'd ever fired a gun.
Holy cow.
Way to go, dude.
The Brian shot it? Hey, he drilled
Brian
it.
Brian shot him. Brian is born again hard.
Derek, how'd you do at your PGF field test?
I think the first shot I took was at about 500 yards, and I hit that one, and then it took me about five shots to shoot at their farthest target at the range we're at, which was 1,000 yards.
Do you have any idea how difficult it would be to have that kind of accuracy for a first-time shooter using a regular weapon?
We actually tried that, and for me, shooting a rather high-end rifle that was very high quality and easy to shoot, about the farthest I could hit was 400 yards, and that was maybe 50% of the time. And this other rifle, once I got it dialed in, it's 100% of the time at 1,000 yards.
So your field test is part of this film, The Long Shot, but there's also you speak with people from the company, you speak with people who are critics of the company. First, the company behind PGF, it's called Tracking Point Solutions. Give us a little summary of their story.
Sure. They're a very young company. They're coming up on being 1 year old. And they unveiled the PGF in early 2013. It was sort of their first big public offering. To date, they're right on pace to sell 500 units by the end of the year. Keep in mind, these things go for $17,000 a pop. Still very much in the early adopter phase. Mm-hmm. Looking ahead to the next year, they're looking to apply the platform that makes the PGF to a full suite of weapons, including drones, and even Google Glass, so you could potentially one day fire your precision-guided rifle by saying, okay, Glass, fire my precision-guided rifle. Mm.
Jason Schobel is the CEO. He's also an Iraq war veteran who was wounded by gunfire in Iraq. He says that this PGF, this technology, could change the nature of combat. Now, are they hoping to sell to the military, or are these being designed for the general public?
They're being designed for both. Tracking Point is aimed definitely at hunters and the sporting market. But most of the people that we interacted with at the company that weren't engineers, which the company is mostly engineers and is very much a tech company, but Jason and most of the other people we interacted with outside of that realm were all ex-military, and they're definitely aimed at that market. And one of the things that really stuck out to me that Jason said was, as you mentioned earlier in the segment, most sniper teams are two-man teams, and they're basically, a little bit on their own because they have to be hidden out, way off in the middle of nowhere. But with this scope, which has its own network built in and has its own video capabilities, and you can stream video from the scope to an iPad or to an iPhone, now it's opening up this possibility to connect the battlefield of snipers being all over the world, all over the battlefield in their own location, but still being targeted and having people directly giving them feedback from somewhere else.
There's this element of unreality, almost a video game component to Tracking Point's smart rifle. In the more overt sense, they use a video game as a training tool. And there's also an app that allows people to capture their kills and then to share them with others. Now, was anybody that you spoke to concerned that this kind of, mediated experience, this kind of gamified experience of shooting could be blurring the line between real world and simulated violence?
Yeah, we spoke to a couple of bioethicists and kind of technoethicists for the piece, Peter Asaro and Jonathan Moreno. And one of the things they both highlighted was, the more we invest in technology, which is the way the world is going and has always been, and it's the same for weapons, they're going to always become more effective because that's what people want. But the more we get into technology and this kind of gamification factor of removing ourselves from the actual act and hiding it behind, a screen and a UI, it makes it so that our decision-making process is different than it ever has been before. And that's something that we saw ourselves, and it's interesting to think once this gets out into the real world, if people have more confidence in their gun or if they are removed from it because they know they're just looking at a screen and the gun is the one that's making the decision to fire, then perhaps we're going to have a different set of ethical equations in our mind than we would if we were shooting a traditional gun on our own. Mm. But when this gun actually gets out into the hand of military and police, which it is going to, it's going to totally change the way we look at firearms. And that's something that we don't know, nor did the experts we talked to. We don't totally know what the ramifications are going to be.
Derek Mead, editor-in-chief at Motherboard and host of the video Long Shot. I want to thank you, Derek, for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And Brian Anderson produced the video, which you can see at wordofmouthradio.org. Brian, thank you also for being with us.
Hey, thank you.
There are plenty of ways to listen to Word of Mouth. On our website, wordofmouthradio.org, you can also download a podcast of the show from iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher, or listen on the NHPR app. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us. Let us know what you're hearing. The best stories are told by Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Bill Berry,
and Zach Nugent.
Our intern is
James Pouliot.
Digital support from Rebecca Lavoie
and Sarah Plord.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.